Okie doke. So, welcome to Introduction to Clinical Bioethics. I'm Autumn Feaster, and hopefully you're in the right class. Now would be your exit time. So I imagine everybody's grabbed the syllabus, and I imagine there'll be some stragglers, and I know there were quite a few people who weren't able to be here tonight. They'll join us next time, and also I'll tell you a lot about the way that the class is structured, but the sections between Tuesday and Thursday will vary significantly week to week, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. So this is our game plan tonight. I'm going to go over the syllabus, nitty-gritty, and all of that kind of thing. And then we're going to get right to the content area for the first week, and I'm going to talk about the legal cases in the end of life. Mostly, I'm going to be talking tonight exclusively about withdrawal of care cases. And then in the next few weeks, as we look at the syllabus, you'll see this, we will be talking about physician-assisted suicide cases. There were specifically two that went before the Supreme Court, and each of those two physician-assisted suicide cases correspond to a very classic piece in bioethics, so we'll look at those two legal cases as the framework for the sessions that we do on physician-assisted suicide. So tonight, we'll really be talking about the legal cases in withdrawing end-of-life care. Okay, but first, let's walk through all of the nitty-gritty stuff about the semester. Come on in. I'm going to put a pile of syllabi. You will not be the last person in, for sure, especially since we trek all the way up to market for the class. So we'll probably have stragglers for a while. Let's talk about some of the things that are unique about this class, and just grab a syllabus and just find a place. Syllabus. Or that way too. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Before I do that, I should probably introduce myself a little bit more thoroughly because I am seeing a lot of new faces. I am the Director of Education here in the Master of Bioethics program. I am a moral philosopher by training, so I have a philosophical approach to bioethics, and that should not frighten you because my job in this introduction class is to presuppose nothing, to presuppose no philosophical background, though my guess is some of you have quite a substantial background in philosophy. That is absolutely not a prerequisite. And in fact, though this is a 600-level class, my job is to get everyone to the level where you can make an argument, a compelling argument, and understand how arguments in bioethics work, to critique them and to make them yourself. So it is a philosophically oriented class, but it is not a class that requires any philosophy background, and I will be doing the work of helping you understand the material and then helping you be able to replicate bioethics arguments, I mean, create them on your own. The areas that I work in bioethics are moral theory and how it applies to bioethics, but specifically I work in clinical ethics. And this class has the title Introduction to Clinical Bioethics to differentiate it from the vast area of bioethics that is about research ethics. So this is really about patients and physicians as opposed to science and researchers. And there is a class, Introduction to Research Ethics, that happens in the spring, which you're welcome to take. So I will not be talking about trials and therapeutic misconception and coercion of subjects. That will all be in the spring. But I will be talking about a lot of philosophical or conceptual bioethical issues that hit the clinical arena. And the areas that I work in addition to this, if I specify the areas in clinical bioethics, I work in LGBT bioethics, and I also work in mediation as an approach to clinical ethics consultation that challenges the orthodoxy in the way that clinical ethics tends to be practiced in the United States. And you'll get to hear more about that actually on the last day of class. All right, that is me. Let's talk about the class itself. The first thing to note about this class is that it is very flexible, and I offer it on purpose on Tuesdays and Thursdays so that it's convenient for you to take it either Tuesday or Thursday, depending on what your schedule is like that week. So it doesn't make any difference what class you're actually signed up for, though it does tend to be the case that Tuesday is a more popular day for folks to take classes than Thursday. So if you like a smaller section, Thursday should be your target, because Tuesday will probably be significantly larger. But that is entirely up to you, and you need never tell me what your plan is. In fact, the class is really large. Introduction to Clinical Bioethics and syllabi right there. Grab one. Because the class is actually larger than this, the room helps you think it's very small, and the fact that it's on two nights makes you think it's quite small. It turns out it's actually quite large, and so if everybody told me when they were going to come on Tuesday and Thursday, I probably have a full-time job managing my email. So you need never tell me what you're doing Tuesday or Thursday. You do it as you choose and works out for you. One thing you do want to note is that this syllabus tells you when I'm doing what lecture on which Tuesday and which Thursday, and it will behoove you to take note of which lecture will be on which Tuesday and Thursday so that you don't end up coming and hearing legal issues and end of life twice and not anything about physician-assisted suicide. So just pay attention to the days of the week on the syllabus when I'm doing the various lectures, and then you just mix and match as is appropriate for you. So that's the first reason why this class is incredibly flexible, because you can come either Tuesday, Thursday, or mix and match. That's one. Two, as you can see from the little gadget here, we record all of our classes. And so if you can't come, you can listen to it. And we put all of the material, and I will speak to this for a second here, on the website, the courses, what we call Blackboard. And I know for many of you, that is old hat, and you are very familiar with what that all means. But for those of you who don't know what Blackboard is, I'm going to give a little mini. Hi, come on in, come on in. Grab a syllabus. You're not the last people, I'm certain of it. And the first 5 minutes, I'm talking about how flexible the course is and all this. The one thing that I want to assure you is it never matters to me if you're late. I never take it personally. I never think, well, it's because I'd rather not listen to an extra 5 minutes of Autumn. I never think that. I know that the reason you're late is because you have other important things to do, or just because you're a procrastinator. And, hey, I'm married to one. So I don't care that you're late. Don't ever be worried, and you don't have to tiptoe in. Just come right on in and find a seat. But for what you have missed, it's on the recording. Okay, I'm at the part of the pitch about the class where I'm telling you that that recording that you're going to need, because you will probably all miss class at some point, and maybe frequently, that recording will be on the website we call Blackboard. And for those of you who have been in school here at Penn or in other institutions for a long time, again, this is a very obvious thing to talk about, but some of you are returning students, haven't been students for quite a while, and maybe when you were a student, there were things like course packs and other things that don't exist. And others of you are looking at me very wide-eyed because you don't know what I mean. You don't know what a course pack is. It was a bulk thing that you got from like Kiko's. And is that the name of that place? You know, it's like a printing place. You paid a whole lot of money for it, like $75, and all the reading was in there, and that's how it used to be done. Well, it isn't done that way anymore. Now, if you go to the Penn website, just, you know, put Penn into your browser, and you get the little corner up to put some in, you know, some search, type the word Blackboard, and that will take you to the part of the Penn Library system where you will log in with your Penn key, which is the first part of your email, your UPenn email, and your password. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't have a Penn key, which is, again, a Penn email and the thing right before the at sign, you put that part in, that's called your Penn key, you'll make up a password, and then anything you're registered for will show up on your Blackboard site. And your Blackboard site will have the syllabus, which you're holding in your hand, and all of the readings, minus two, which I'll talk to you about in a minute. So anything that can be photocopied, we have already gotten copyright protection and photocopied for you on Blackboard. And all the readings are there, and they're already uploaded for the entire semester. And announcements will go through Blackboard, and emails, and once we have the paper assignment, everything will be up on this site. And if you have any trouble at all accessing Blackboard, then the contact person for you is my assistant, Robin Hartley, and you can see that she's available here at MBE Paper. She's also available at, they probably have her Hartley number. Her name is Robin Hartley, and you can reach her that way by just going to Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy website and clicking on her. But MBE Paper will always get to her, so if you're having any trouble understanding what I'm talking about here to access the readings, you can talk to Robin and she'll help you. Okay, now some of you will say, I don't want to read things up, because I don't have a Kindle or whatever, so I don't want to read material electronically. I want to have an honest-to-God kill-a-tree and have it here and then recycle it article. And yet I don't have a printer. That may be what you're thinking. So the good news is, down this hall, there is a student lounge. It looks like a big fishbowl and it has couches in it. And if you go into that couchy area, there are two student computers and a printer. So you can just go ahead and print the week's reading if you don't have access to a printer and you like to print. And while you're there, grab yourself some coffee because there's a kitchen and it has a Keurig, and all students who take classes with us are welcome to coffee, tea, and cocoa and water, so help yourself. Questions on any of that? Blackboard, readings, coffee, printers. Yes?
How much is the printing?
The price of the class, which, depending on where you are as a student, could be anywhere from $50,000 to $5,000, depending on whether you're a med student, a law student. After you've paid for the tuition, we don't make you pay for anything else. Yes, so for the $50,000 you're paying as a med student, you get the printing for free. It's a great, great bargain. And the coffee's free, too. It's all good.
It's not free in our lounge, the printing.
In the med student lounge, after they make you pay the $50,000, they make you pay for the printing. That's why you tell your friends to come take Introduction to Clinical Bioethics, where they can at least get some free printing. Okay, yes, all the printing is free. The coffee, the tea are all free. And actually, use of the bathrooms is free, too, because it's just like all-inclusive. So right back there, if you see right next to those folks in the corner, do you see a big ring? That's so you don't pocket it. Those are the bathroom keys. And if you walk down this hall and instead of going left into the free coffee printing area, you go right, that's where the bathrooms are. Bring the key back. Okay. Let's talk about using the bathroom while we're in class. Just go in and out. Just leave when you need to leave and come when you want to come and come late or don't come or listen to the recordings or whatever. Class is very flexible. Part of the reason that I want to urge you to understand this is a very flexible class is because I don't actually give you any bathroom breaks. I don't pause halfway through and hit the button and then say, all right, everybody disperse for 15 minutes and chat and whatever, and we'll get back together. I run the class straight through, 4:30, 6:30. I am so punctual, which doesn't mean you have to be, but I will get you out of here at 6:30 on the dot so you can have dinner. But that means whenever you need to leave for coffee or tea or printing or talk to your friends or whatever, just go ahead and do it. Okay? And I seriously do not mind. And I think we've got the chairs organized so that you can actually get in and out fairly easily. So hopefully. Questions on any of that? No? Alrighty. Good. Already talked about coming late, don't worry about it. You can't come at all, don't worry about it. If you are going to be absent, don't tell me. Just listen to the recording. And the recording, as I said, will be on the section of Blackboard that has the title Recordings, helpfully. And the class runs Tuesday or Thursday. Again, you mix and match as you wish. And the recordings will be up usually the next day. So it doesn't take long. Questions on any of that. Also, though I, as if you were here at the very beginning, sometimes you can see that I'm not so good at the little gadget and I make mistakes with the gadget, but I get two tries every week to actually get the thing recorded. So if I botch it or I have just a horrific day, I've got another session to get it right. So it's all good. Questions on any of that? Okay, good. Let's walk through some of the syllabus. Let's start at the top. The best way to reach me is email, and even my phone number goes to email. So it's email or email. And I have a very quick response time, so when you need me, you will be able to find me. I don't do office hours because folks who take graduate classes almost always have something else to do at the very time when the faculty member schedules an office hour. So there's just no point. When you need to see me, you're just going to email me directly, with the exception of one critical time in the semester. And that's when it's time for us to do the outlines, which I haven't talked to you about, and I will. At that time, which is around, they come to me around the 25th of October. Right after that, when I start giving the outlines back, many, many people will want to see me, far more people than I can handle the email volume for. And at that point, Robin Hartley, my assistant, will take over the scheduling for folks so that everybody can get in a very efficient way that works for your schedule. She'll have big blocks of time from me, and she'll help you find a good time to meet with me if you want to meet with me to talk about the assignment. So except for that, that's about a two-week block. All other times you just email me directly, just that strange window where we're talking, we could be talking as many as 115 people trying to get in. Everyone will get in, that's a guarantee for you, but during that block, you're going to want to talk to Robin, and you'll know it. Until you hear me say you're going to go through Robin, you just email me directly whenever you need me. Okay, it'll be very clear when we get to that point in the semester. So that's why there's no office hours, but you've got all my contact information, and as I said, I am a 24/7 emailer. It is ridiculous. I mean, last night I went to bed at 9:30, but I checked email at midnight and 2:30. So believe me, when people say 24/7, I live the talk. It is a sin. All right, so you'll be able to find me. Let's talk about the readings. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's talk about the readings that are not on Blackboard. There are two books that I would like you to buy. The first book is a classic, is the classic. If there's one text in bioethics that everyone ought to have, that text is The Principles of Biomedical Ethics. And it was written, is written by Tom Beauchamp, and it's not Beauchamp. So if you're at the cocktail party and you want to look like you're in the know, you're going to say Beauchamp, not Beauchamp. Gives you away right away as an amateur. And it's written by his co-author, Jim Childress, who is currently at UVA, and Beauchamp is at Georgetown. The two of them together, and if you ever come to the second semester of this class, it has a companion, 601, and is paired with a class called 602, which is unsexily called Conceptual Foundations, but it's actually a really great class. It's a class that is my absolute favorite, though I love this one too, and is often students' favorite as well. And Art Kaplan went on record once saying that it sounds like the Bataan Death March. But I got to tell you, it's actually a really fun class where you learn about how arguments are really built in bioethics from various camps in bioethics. At any rate, at the end of that semester, I talk about what I think is fundamentally wrong with the approach that Beauchamp and Childress created, which is nicknamed the Georgetown Mantra. And if you have ever heard of four moral principles talked about in a series, autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, even if you didn't know what that foursome is, that's the Georgetown Mantra, and those two people created it, and they created it in 1979. And actually, as a matter of fact, it was created in the Belmont Report, which Tom Beauchamp was the research associate on, and he took those three from the Belmont Report and made it into a book that was now called the Georgetown Mantra. That's a little bit of history you can get in the research ethics class in the spring. At any rate, they got the credit for it. They keep doing new editions, and the reason that I ask you to buy the book is twofold. First of all, I use it all year round. Only once each time, though, I'm already admitting to you. But also, it is a classic to be on the shelf. And I think in terms of some of the important concepts of bioethics, like informed consent or confidentiality, it's still the best synopsis of the concept out there. So those are the reasons I ask you to buy it. New, it is fairly expensive. I think it runs $35, $40 new. but there are a gazillion editions. I think they're in the sixth edition right now, and I don't care what edition you buy, because I will give you a page translator. Because the strategy of this book is to have a theoretical section, let's say, on informed consent, and then 10 pages of discussion of literature of late that is talking about informed consent. That's what is new every time they do the edition, that literature about informed consent. But I don't actually have us read those sections. I only have us read the classic explanation of the concept, and it's the same in every edition going all the way back to the first. So I'll give a page translator. So if you've got the third edition or the fifth edition or the second or the sixth, doesn't make any difference. We'll give you the pagination so you know exactly what pages to read. And that makes buying this book actually very inexpensive. Just go to an online bookstore, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever, and you're going to be able to find the book very inexpensively. And the only thing you're going to miss is the literature that keeps changing, because, of course, as in medicine, bioethics literature, not the kind of stuff I'm doing in this class, but the kind of stuff that bioethicists typically are publishing, doesn't have a long shelf life, and it's that that's changing every time they do a new volume. So it's nice to have one of the updated volumes, but it's not necessary. So I want you to buy that book. Though, if it's a hardship, after the $50,000 you're paying for the other degree that you're in, let me know and we can try to figure out how to photocopy it for you. It's not that long. The second book I'd like you to read is a book by Paul Monet called Borrowed Time, and it's a novel, and it's very inexpensive, very inexpensive. The reason I want you to buy this book, and I want you to get started reading it whenever you feel it's a novel. It's actually a biography, not a novel. But it's the story. Paul Monet is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He was a screenwriter as well in Hollywood. And this is the story of his partner, Roger, struggle with AIDS in the height of the AIDS epidemic pre-cocktail, before there was any HART, any ART, any... what is the name of the first drug that was out there? AZT. Right, this is prior to AZT. And the reason I want you to read it is because I think it's one of the most effective depictions of suffering from the patient's perspective. And we're going to have a session where we talk about suffering and the meaning of suffering from the various perspectives. And I think this book does a beautiful job of illustrating the worldview from the... It's a caretaker's perspective, but very much trying to give the insider view. And yes, it was AIDS in America at a very particular time, but the struggle with life-threatening illness, I think, is very well depicted, and it is it's a book hard to put down, heart-wrenching, yes, because Roger dies, and in the end, not the end of this book, there's a second book that Paul Monet writes after this one called Half a Life. It's the one that won the Pulitzer, but Paul Monet did die in 1994. His partner died, I think, in 1986. Roger died in 1986. Paul Monet died as well from AIDS, and he had AIDS at the time. He was HIV positive at the time when his partner was dying. It's a beautiful book, and it is very inexpensive. So those are the two books that I would like you to buy. I know some people in the class have actually already read it because they saw that it was on the syllabus and started reading it. You can't put it down. So any questions about those two books? No? Okay. All righty. You know where the class is because we're in it. So there you go. I'm going to talk about the requirements and give you a little bit of a lengthy explanation about them now, because I think it's really important, especially for those of you shopping, to understand what you're getting into. And so I want you to know what the game plan is. But what will ultimately happen is that you will do one assignment in two parts, and they're both pretty short in terms of pages. And they will both get handed into me either... Maybe you're going to actually do this kind of thing, print, staple, all good. I can accept papers like this. Or you'll probably do it the way most people do it, which is to send an electronic version. That electronic version needs to go to Robin Hartley because it is surprisingly time-consuming to print and staple and document and give a return receipt for 100 people in a class. It sounds like it would be a really simple task, but it's not, and I don't have good wrists. So I have Robin collating all of those papers. And that's actually a good thing, too, because she keeps track of when those assignments come in. So again, there'll be two. There'll be one around the end of October, and then there'll be one in December. And they are related, and I'm going to talk about those in a second. But send them to Robin unless you hand them to me. and that's the address MBE paper. Any questions so far? Okay, either I'm super clear or you're all asleep. It's all good. All right, let's talk about the two requirements. Anyone who's going to do any substantial work in bioethics has to understand how to make an argument. Has to understand how to make an argument in a way that is persuasive and respectful of the person you're trying to persuade. And this is actually very different from the way that some of you who are in the argument business, like law students or lawyers, make arguments in your daily life. Like how? Let's think about lawyers in litigation. They don't actually care if the opponent ends up friends. And they don't care if they persuade the opponent. They're only rhetorically trying to persuade the jury or the judges. And so they have a very different bar when it comes to how do you talk to your opponent. So lawyers in litigation are often scathing about the opponent. But in bioethics, you're actually trying to persuade people who are your professional colleagues. And if you haven't persuaded them, if you've only talked to the converted, let's say, those who are converted to your own view, and that's who you hobnob with, and that's all you want to make an impact on, you can just talk to yourself, but you're not making any change in the world. To make change in the world, you have to get the person who's on the other side of the table to not only think that your position is worth thinking about, but to think that you did it in a way that leaves them dignity and self-respect at the end of it. So it's actually quite a skill set to not only be able to make a powerful argument to be able to rebut and refute the opponent's argument, and everybody ends up friends, and you have a hope of actually changing the world in the direction you think your argument is directing you towards. That is the skill I'm going to teach you this semester. And I want you to be able to make a very compelling argument to people that you would want to stay friends with, to be able to get across what you want to get across and make the impact in the world that you want to make. That's my goal. And I'm going to do that with a very small exercise. So I have a very lofty goal, and I have a very small exercise to do it with. And this is what I'm going to do. And I've done this year after year, and I have a lot of success with it. So while it looks a little pedantic sometimes from the outside, I'd like you to just stay open-minded that as a method, this really does help you become a stronger arguer and write better papers. Now, when you ultimately leave this class, and maybe you hope that sooner rather than later, you will make big arguments. You will make 15-page arguments and 25-page arguments, and if you're a lawyer, you will make 80-page arguments, and that's fabulous. But the thing about arguments, and if you're philosophically trained, you know that this is true, is that it is the same rigor in doing a 4-page argument as it is doing an 80-page argument. It's just where you're expanding the argument that makes the difference. But argumentatively, structurally, there's really no difference. That's why, for example, if you end up in the Master of Bioethics program, for your final project, the final thesis that you do to get out of here, you could do a piece that is only 1,200 words and actually graduate, because commentary arguments in the New England Journal, in JAMA, in Lancet, they're all between 900 and 1,500 words. And you've got to get in, you've got to be tight, you've got to be persuasive, make your case, get out, and have changed the world. So it isn't how many words, it's what are you doing with the words. So if I teach you a technique where you can make a really compelling 1,200-word paper, I'm teaching you a technique that you can write a 20-page or 30-page or an 80-page. But I don't want to read 80 pages of folks who are trying to learn how to make an argument, and you understand. I need it to be small so it can be rigorous and it can be highly examined so that we can take it apart and understand all of what's going right in it and what's going wrong. And to do that, the exercise is very constrained. It's not only constrained, it's almost pedantic is a nice word, but it's almost an exercise. So all the great papers you want to write in bioethics, all the arguments that you see, all the clinical ethics problems you want to address, you will, but not in this class. In this class, you're going to do an argument about physician-assisted suicide, and you're going to do it in a way that is very regimented and highly structured and rigid. And that's because all you're doing in this class is learning a technique that you're going to employ in all other aspects, even if you don't go on to another bioethics class. Knowing how to make a persuasive argument is the kind of writing that you can use in any field at all. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to give me a 2-page outline. That's the midterm, 2-page outline. Not going to be graded. It's just going to be ruthlessly, you know, constructively commented on. I think your opponent's going to be offended here. Here's an argument that I think has an easy rebuttal and you think it's strong. Here's an argument I think that's really compelling, but I wonder if you could add this to it. That's what you're going to get back from this 2-page outline. And if at the end you get this thing at the bottom that says, good to go, you're ready to just write it up for the final. If you get something that says, this could use some tweaking, then I would suggest you actually redo it. You do a second midterm. Again, not graded, but you just get it right. And I'm going to tell you why I want you to do that. If you get a, if we better talk, that's probably because you're from a discipline where you're not used to making arguments. That's not what people do in the world you're in. There's a lot of places in medicine. For example, you're not an academic nurse or an academic clinician. Doctors and nurses don't tend to make philosophical arguments. It's just a different kind of genre. So you may be very well published in empirical clinical work, for example, but not how to actually make a philosophical argument. So sometimes you'll get this, maybe we should talk, and then I'll help you, and I'll work with you on what's going wrong here and what's the strategies that you need to employ to tighten up that skill set. At any rate, you'll decide how much you want to put into this, but my advice is you work on it until you get a good to go. Because here's the thing that you don't probably know unless you're a philosopher. Once you have an outline, you are only a few hours from a completed paper. And that is the truth. A 2-page outline that says good to go is a 2-hour exercise to getting the final done and getting an A. And that's the truth. An outline, tight, to turn into a 4-to-6-page paper is just sitting there and banging out the prose around the outline. Now, why not let you do prose to start out with? Because prose masks... what is the polite word for BS? Prose masks arguments that are not tight. Prose uses rhetorical flourish to pull the wool over people's eyes, to bring them along, to not be able to show the bare bones and show your true cards. Prose is very helpful at that, and that's why people use rhetorical flourishes when they do speech writing rather than, you know, tight argumentation. So I need to see the bare bones argument to see how good it is. Putting the prose to it is a very simple matter. Everybody can do that. It's the tight argument that matters. How can I prove to you that this is true? If you reach back to undergrad, or maybe you have to go back to high school or someplace, where you read a philosophical argument, like some piece from Plato, the thing that's so hard about being a student in a philosophy class is that every argument sounds good. I mean, you read one argument and you are absolutely a libertarian, and then you read another one and you are utilitarian. You read another one and you're a deontologist, and you're swinging around like this all the time. And that's what philosophy feels like at the sophomore level, because you're reading prose. And the prose, you can't actually pick apart the arguments. So I'm not going to just ask you to do this outline de novo. I'm going to work all semester working through arguments that people are giving in the real world, in the philosophical world, helping you learn the skill of picking apart where are you getting snowed. Where is the sleight of hand? Where's the argument that doesn't really hold, but they did a rhetorical flourish and copied right over it? I'm going to make you savvy critics, and making you a savvy critic is going to make you a savvy writer and a savvy thinker. So you're going to do this outline, going to work on it, get it right, and then you're going to ultimately just dash it out. There's nothing between the outline and that final. That is no effort at all. Put all of the effort into the outline. I'm not kidding you. It's a couple of hours at the computer banging it out, just building the prose around the sentences. It's that simple. Questions about any of that? I'm going to give a whole session on how we do this after we've got a little bit under our belt.
Are we going to revise the paper at all, or is that the final?
Nope, and you're not going to need to, because if you grab a syllabus, because if you want to do well on the paper, you're just going to get the outline to the point where it says good to go, because good to go means you're going to get an A. You can't fail. You can't, first of all, you can't fail, because we've got great inflation, not the yin-yang. But you can't fail to get an A when you've got a comment on an outline that says good to go. It's not possible. You can't botch an excellent argument by bad prose. You just don't have it in you. Prose is just the thing that carries people along. Now, that's a pretty radical view, and if you're an English literature major, you're probably suffocating, and I'm very sorry for it, because there are disciplines in the world that believe that language is really very, the type of language and the eloquence of the language is the thing in itself. But that's not what philosophers or bioethicists think. They think the guts is all that matters, and the guts is the argument. And once the argument is good, you're not going to need to revise the paper. Spend your time revising the outline, and then put 2 hours into putting it into prose. Questions? Yeah.
In the back of my mind, I kind of have a fear in expressing my own knowledge on the paper, because you know all the principles and theories that you can compare.
Yes,
but
how are you going to succeed? Yeah, no, it's good. This is such a rigged argument that I'm not going to let you use any theories, and I'm not going to let you use any background. This is going to be an argument about pure consequences. There's no reason to hide what it's going to be. I'm going to ask you to do a pro-con analysis of whether we should legalize or not legalize physician-assisted suicide, and I'm not going to let you use any theories. I'm going to ask you to argue, will we be better off or worse off? Will people be happier? Will they be hurt? Will they benefit? And if not, and they won't benefit, in what ways will they be harmed? And we're going to do 3 weeks, the next 3 weeks, on physician-assisted suicide and the consequences. So, and then we're going to have a two-hour session on, all right, let's talk about what the pros and the cons are. And everybody's going to throw pros and cons into the discussion. And you're going to have a whole bucket of pros and cons to pick from. And then you are going to weigh and balance them. It's not going to be any mystery. I don't want anything original, because this is just an exercise. So you're not going to have to worry that you don't know anything original. We're all going to work together. And this is, by the way, an open note, open friend, open, you know, internet kind of exercise. Because here's the thing. To refute somebody's argument, to challenge somebody's argument, you can't make this crap up. You got to know how to do it, and I'm going to teach you how to do it. But I'm not going to ask you to pull out any theories or principles. It's going to be a very constrained bucket of pros and cons.
But your argument can be influenced by what you have read. Let's say to make a paper, let's say I browsed around some philosophical books, I could have an influence in the way to form my own idea.
And that's fair game. But what I want to assure you today is that if you work hard on the outline, you're going to do great in the class. The only way that you won't do spectacularly well in the class is if you're like, look, I'm going to do one outline, and if she likes it, she likes it, and if she doesn't, she doesn't, and that's it. Anybody who wants to work on the outline, I gave 95% A's, A or A minus, and a couple of B pluses, and maybe a couple of people were like, screw it, I don't care, I'm just writing down, I don't care, that it doesn't matter, B's. I mean, it is very hard to warrant your anxiety. It just, grad school's not like that. It's not like med school or law school or nursing school. It's just not like that. My goal is to get across to you, how do you do this task, and I will do anything it takes, and as long as you're willing to work at it, you will absolutely get an A in this class. That's the end of the story. There's just nothing to worry about. And when I get 3 weeks from now, when I introduce this, you will have no worries at all. Nope, it's not going to be a worry. Just take it right off your plate. I know right now it's all in the abstract. It won't be. It won't be. It's a very simple exercise, as long as you just, you know, work at what needs to be done. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about handing it in. Because here's another thing that's very odd about this class, and I think in a good way, though sometimes people find this feature, they think it sounds really good, but when it gets down to the moment of truth, they sometimes don't hold up their end of the bargain. So I'm going to tell you a funny story. I don't care when you hand it in. It says you have to hand it in on October 25th. And you do if you want to get it back in a timely fashion. If you want to get it back 2 weeks from October 25th, you have to hand it in October 25th at 3 o'clock. Because we're going to run out of time. by the time I've graded 100 to 120, I know it doesn't look like this class is that large, but it's already well into the 80s right now, and we still have a big shopping period left. By the time last year it had 120 people in it, by the time I've gotten through all these outlines and I've carefully looked through them, it's time for you to write the final, you know, by the time I've met with everybody. So if you don't have it in on the 25th at 3 o'clock, you're going to get put into a folder that says to be graded. And the to be graded folder won't get opened up again until after finals. Does that matter? It does not, in terms of any grade that you'll get from me. So here's the thing, and I'm going to say it really clearly. If you get the paper in on October 25th, you'll get it back in a timely fashion, and then if you hand it in by Friday, December 14th at noon, you will have a grade the first week of January, and your life will go on, and I think we'll all just live and prosper. If you don't get the paper in on October 25th, there will be no penalty, ever. People carry incompletes in this class literally for years. 7, 6, 4 years. There's a syllabus right here, Bill. Years people carry incompletes, and once they've done the work, they just get the grade. Just gets erased, and they get the grade. Now, there are some constraints. If you're a medical student, you actually have to have the class done by the time you graduate 4 years from now, or however more years you've got, because Helene Weinberg at the medical school will not let you out. She will not let you out. Same thing if you're a JD. You got a three-year program, you got to get it done. That's not my rule. That's theirs. Besides that, I absolutely do not care. But here's the thing. A lot of people, and you get me doing the grading. Most classes that are this large have a TA, and you got some TA doing the grading. You got me. You got me, and I got a lot of experience, and I can do a lot of good for you in this skill set. But I already have blocked off the number of hours it's going to take between October 25th and November, whatever it is, to get all those things graded. If you miss the window, you go into the to-be-graded pile. And then I get to it after the people who handed in on time. It's not a punishment. It's just coping. It's just enabling the people that got it in when they could get in. Is it pejorative? It is not. You can hand it in whenever you want. And lots of people hand it in very late. But here's the thing. You got to do the outline, and you got to get comments back, and then you can do the final. You can't just go right for the final. Because that's not me teaching you. This is a class that has a stunningly low number of pages for a full credit, you know, class. 4 to 6 pages is your total assignment. So you got to do it in the sequence. So that means that, for example, when you got it in on November 1st, and I don't have it back to you, are you going to call me and email me and berate me for how you don't have the paper back? No. Right. That's the thing. So if you want it back in a timely fashion and hold me accountable, then you got to get it in on time. So I actually had this, I had a student who, she was 3 years late with the paper, and she wanted to graduate on, like, let's say, May 11th. So she hands it to me on May 8th, and she wants me to grade it between the 8th and 11th. I didn't have time. So she gets her dad involved, and the dad calls, and they're yelling. It's a three-year late paper, and everybody's upset. Finally, I'm like, okay, let's path of least resistance it. Let's just go ahead and see if we can get this thing graded. It had been so long. This wasn't the fall class. It's the spring class. There's two assignments. It had been so long, she forgot that there was actually a second assignment. She had only handed me the first. Anyway, she didn't get to graduate, because even if I had graded it, which I would have, she didn't have the final done. She only had the midterm. That story is only to convey to you that incompletes don't matter. You can carry them as long as you want, but you're going to have a delay in grading, and you're not going to be able to complain. Right? Okay. But it doesn't matter if you get an incomplete. In fact, for those of you who are in other very demanding programs where you're going to have tests and other exams and other paper requirements, I practically encourage you to take your time and take the stress off yourself and just say, you know what, I'm probably just going to get an incomplete. I'm going to hand the outline in sometime this semester. I'll get it back right around final time, and I'll use, you know, that holiday break to finish the paper, and I will not have to stress about my other classes. It actually can be a great advantage to you. So, again, there's no punishment involved in getting an incomplete. I'll erase it the minute the stuff gets in and I have it graded, so it's not a worry. But the deadlines are hard and fast in terms of timely return. Questions? Objections? refutations? Dropping of the class? It's all good. All right, let's look quickly here at the syllabus, and then I want to get on. Of course, I would have forgotten my watch, and the clock's behind that thing, so somebody give me the time.
5:15.
I've got plenty of time. Good. All righty. So here's our game plan. Tonight, I'm going to talk about withdrawal cases, legal cases at the end of life. Then we're going to do 3 sessions on physician-assisted suicide in preparation for the paper. Mostly, this is going to be theoretical stuff. And you're not going to be asked to do anything theoretical on the paper, but it's going to help you know what your paper is not about. It will be the paper that is not what you're writing. So we're going to look at classic arguments in physician-assisted suicide, and we will ask you to get started on that Monette book. Then I'm going to do an entire session on how to make an argument. I'm going to teach you the skill set that I think you need to go out and use this class for whatever other kind of writing, persuasive argument that you would like to make. Then we'll talk about the, and when I say paper assigned on the 9th and the 11th, once I've given it out on the 9th, I'll post it to both sections of Blackboard, because I never know who's actually taking it on a Thursday and who's actually taking it on a Tuesday. You'll see that all the deadlines are like clustered, except that one for the outline due date. So when I say paper assigned between the 9th and the 11th, you'll have it on the 9th. If you don't come to class till the 11th, you won't get the explanation till the 11th, but it'll be out on the 11th. Okay. Then I will talk about the experience of illness, because I think that a lot of times bioethics talks about ethical issues but misses the first person, what is it like to be ill, and what is suffering that actually generates all kinds of ethical obligations, but also ethical landmines, the kind of problems that come to an ethics committee or to an ethics consultant service. And that's when we're going to talk about that book, Borrowed Time, but also this very beautiful piece that was in the New England Journal called The Nature of Suffering and the Goals of Medicine by a physician named Eric Castle. So we will also talk about a physician perspective looking at suffering as well as a caretaker perspective on that day. All right, then we have a week off because there is a fall break, and then there's the National Bioethics Conference. There won't be a soul here. Everything is in Washington. I urge you to come. It's an interesting conference, and it's not usually nearby, and it is nearby this time, and Penn has a very prominent role in the national conference, for one thing, because it's the top flight bioethics institution nationally. Many of us are on the program, but also Penn has an evening reception, and the master's program has a huge booth. So at any rate, perhaps you'll be able to join us at some point. Then we're going to talk about professional ethics, and that will be in late October. Then we're going to look at 2 key concepts that you can't be without classically to understand bioethics: confidentiality and informed consent. And then we're going to look at reproductive ethics by looking at abortion, a classic argument in abortion. And finally, we're going to end up with an argument about mediation and versus clinical ethics consultation. Again, let me remind you of what is the strategy of this class. It's to introduce you to the way that arguments are built so that no matter what you read from hereafter, you're going to understand how to read critically and how to be able to protect your own positions when you're trying to defend them against someone who disagrees. So it really is a class that's very skill-based, and we're going to use classical, canonical pieces in bioethics to do it. Questions? Thoughts?
All right, are you sure? We got a couple more minutes while I load this baby up and get the lights down.
They've had enough.
Okay, now, will I put it in the dark? Yeah, all right, hang on.
All right, here we go. So, depending on how you look at the legal history in the United States, you may pick different cases as those that are most pressing in their implications for clinical ethics. I'm going to tell you the array that is often thought to be the most important set, and there they are. Quinlan, we're going to talk about at length today. Bouvet, again, if you want to be in the know for the cocktail party, Bouvet, not Bouvia. Cruzan, that's the sine qua non. That's perhaps the biggest case of all. Washington versus Glucksberg, Vacco versus Quill, then Wendlin versus Wendlin, and the Gonzales case. What I have here are the end of life withdrawal of care cases, and that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Quinlan, Bouvet, Cruzan, and then this very interesting Wendlin. Yes?
Is this going to be on Blackboard?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Everything will be on Blackboard. Yep. Absolutely. So you don't have to be scrambling if you just need the PowerPoints. Absolutely. I'll get those up. Robin will get those up tonight. And these are the physician-assisted suicide cases, these two that went before the Supreme Court. They went before the Supreme Court at the very same time. I'll explain one of them next week and one of them the week after. And then 2 weeks from now, I'll talk to you about the Gonzales case. But Gonzales was the attorney general under Bush, in the Bush administration. And Gonzales is the case where the Bush administration tries to make unconstitutional the Oregon law, the Death with Dignity Act, that enables folks to have access to physician-assisted suicide in Oregon. Right now, you can have physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, Washington, Montana, and maybe Vermont. Somebody can check that. But at the time of Vacco and Glucksberg, it was only in Oregon and up to 2006. These are very recent. This is 2008, these extra two states. But the Gonzales case was the Bush administration's attempt to get the Oregon law considered unconstitutional, and it actually failed. Even though he had a very conservative Supreme Court, the Supreme Court protected the Oregonians' right to have the Death with Dignity Act. But that we will be talking, these three cases we're going to be talking about in the next 2 weeks, not tonight. So tonight I'm going to be talking about the set that is about withdrawal of care. And you'll see how nicely that will lead us into the questions of physician-assisted suicide. So at any point you want to stop me, please do. I'm always happy to be interrupted. So anytime you have a question, just shoot your hand up. And there are people in this room, it's a very interdisciplinary group in this course, and there are people in this room who have far more expertise than I do in legal cases, because your lawyers are law students. So if you hear me as a philosopher taking any misstep, let me urge you to just shoot your hand right up and get me back on track. So do not hesitate. One of the things that is so fabulous about taking classes in this department is how diverse and how much expertise we actually have collated here into one room. And that means we need to make use of that expertise. And that goes for any discipline that you're coming from: social work, nursing, medicine, law. When you hear something that doesn't seem like it's consistent with the discipline you're from and your fact base, dental medicine, social work, whatever it is, clergy, you just make sure that you get that voice right in there so that we have a really informed discussion. All right, I'm going to start us off with Quinlan. Who wants to sacrifice their watch for the cause? Does anyone wear a watch anymore?
Yeah, I have one.
You do?
Yeah.
And you're not leaving like your friends?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I do not care. I'm that's just a joke. I'm just very quirky. Okay, very good. I've got plenty of time, and this will be a nice watch in case you decide to leave it here. So that's all good, too. All right. Very good. I think I could definitely use a red watch. Okay. I am setting this up so I can see it. And here we go. All right. You've all heard about Quinlan. It was 1975. It was a very different era, and you're going to see how very distinct this era is, because some of the things that are going to be said in this case are going to strike you immediately as hopelessly out of date. But it kicked off patient-centered decision-making about withdrawal of life support. No doubt about it. Quinlan is the big kickoff for the modern bioethical era of patient-centered medicine. That is going to be Autumn's claim. Here is the fact pattern. On April 15th in 1975,